Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only, and they're not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From MarketWatch by Chuck Jaffe, credit card issuers find creative ways to skirt the new law. Between now and February 22nd, when the new credit card rules go into effect, you'll see a lot of excited media types talking about all of the good to come out of those regulations. But as a consumer, you should worry about what's still on the menu. The credit card issuers have been cooking up all kinds of new things that their bottom line will find appetizing, but that may make you sick. The Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure Act, known as the CARD Act, aims to help consumers deal with credit card issuers' more troubling policies. But by the time this reform is fully in place, the industry will have moved on to new ways to skin the customer, ways that have become evident over the last few months as the first provisions of the law came into play and financial services businesses scrambled to squeeze through loopholes. The provisions of the CARD Act were excellent and they addressed key problems, but because card issuers are in the business to make money, you had to think they would find other ways to make up for the revenue they were losing because of the law, said Bill Hardikoff of lowcards.com. Now they are instituting a number of other practices, perfectly legal even after the new law, to make up for lost revenue, and consumers now have some new things to worry about. The new law was designed to defeat several bad practices. For example, starting in February, due dates for monthly statements must be the same each month. Any payment amount beyond the minimum must be applied to the highest rate debt on the account. Rate hikes on existing balances on fixed rate cards are prohibited under most conditions. Card issuers can't charge additional fees when consumers pay by mail, electronic transfer, online, or phone unless the customer requests an expedited payment to avoid late fees. Other practices like double cycle billing, where the issuer adds finance charges for previous billing cycles to an account that was paid off because there was an average daily balance until the debt was paid, are off the menu too. It's all good, but beware of what's coming next. Out with the bad and in with the worse. Not surprisingly, lenders are using fees as a main weapon. About 80% of all credit cards carry no annual fee, but many issuers are starting to put fees in place. Even if they don't charge an annual fee, issuers are adding inactivity fees for consumers who don't use the card to make purchases or those who don't make a certain amount of purchases in a 12-month period. Lenders are also hiking balance transfer fees and removing caps and limits that might otherwise make transfer offers more consumer-friendly. Issuers are also raising minimum finance charges so that if your balance is so much as a penny, the lender is guaranteed a charge of, say, $5. Also, they've instituted what industry watchers describe as picker rate pricing on variable rate cards that are tied to an index. Rather than linking to, say, the prime rate and altering what you pay whenever the prime rises or falls, some lenders tie a variable rate car to the highest prime rate within a 90-day period. Thus, when rates go down, your variable rate lags behind the move, but when rates go up, you get tagged right away. A recent study by the Center for Responsible Lending says this one change in how rates are calculated can result in annual percentage rates that are 0.3% higher than traditional pricing. Further, they estimate that it is already costing consumers $720 million annually. With the new rules basically encouraging card issuers to move toward variable rate offers because they must give 45 days notice before raising any fixed rates, you can expect this kind of rate fixing to become much more standard practice. If that happens, according to the Center for Responsible Lending, the cost to consumers could more than triple. And how about an 80% interest rate? Similarly, card issuers are putting a floor rate on their variable rate cards, which typically means the current rate has little or no room to drop now or in the future, but has infinite opportunity to rise. Then there are the truly egregious efforts to make money in a post-Card Act world. First Premier Bank, a subprime card issuer, introduced a card with a rate of 79.9%. That's correct, 79.9%. The new law caps fees for subprime cards at 25% of the available credit line. First Premier has been offering a card with a minimum of $256 in fees on a credit line of $250. Obviously, that kind of deal, aimed at someone who has a horrible credit history but who needs a card, most likely is an attempt to rebuild their credit, gets killed when the Card Act becomes law. One possible replacement is a card charging $75 in fees on a $300 limit, but with that 80% annual percentage rate on purchases. Some card issuers even are re-engineering double cycle billing, where they charge you the interest up front and rebate the interest if you pay the bill in full. Fail to pay off your balance each month and the upfront charge increases your costs to where they are the same as with the soon-to-be-illegal double-cycle billing. Experts suggest consumers need to watch their cards and any changes in terms carefully because the items that will inspire the new twist on the Card Act are happening now as the law takes away the old standard methods for fleecing consumers. The difference between now and a year or two ago was that you could take your business elsewhere if you didn't like what they were doing, said Jerry Detweiler, personal finance advisor for Credit.com. Now, given the economy and how card issuers are tightening up, it's increasingly hard to do that unless you have really good credit and don't need the card, she said. If you need a card and don't have a great credit score, you may just have to live with whatever the card issuers come up with next. So that's Chuck Jaffe, who is a senior Market Watch columnist. And some food for thought by attorney Kathy Cruz, a preeminent bankruptcy attorney from Arkansas. She says, I don't mind paying my just debts or my clients paying their just debts. But most of the stuff that gets written off are credit card debts wherein the client actually borrowed $1,000, paid back $3,000, and still owes $5,000. Or got handed a 10% interest mortgage because the originator made more money even though the client qualified for a much lower interest rate. Or the hospital charged them full tilt boogie when they had no insurance, even though the same hospital charges 70% less to the government and insured patients. I just have a hard time believing that Jesus would find that the creditors who claim this kind of debt are being very Christian. And it also seems to me that the amount of just debt written off by consumers pales in comparison to debt written off by major corporations. And corporations run by CPAs don't have to do debt counseling or debt education, which is required of the consumers trying to do bankruptcy. And how Christian is it to sell discharge debt to debt buyers? I frankly just don't see many Christian business models out there in this area. The one thing I do see that is Christian is that debtors are being forced to turn the other cheek when they get flim-flammed by these greedy business models who then want to belittle our debtors for falling for their schemes and rely on the fine print in the deal they were tricked into agreeing to. So that's a personal opinion of attorney Kathy Cruz from Arkansas, commenting on the debt creation and collection system. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's move to the second segment of the show, where we have been learning from the two-income trap, why middle-class parents are going broke, by authors Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi. And with this, I start with the credit, because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. And I do highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. I also suggest that you visit the archives at www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the shows which have been produced and which are interrelated to help you to deal with issues about debt as it exists, preventing it, and building some kind of stable financial plan for yourself now and in the future. Last week, I was talking about the two-income trap, turning back the clock, with the notion that the modern mother had joined the workforce, but can she give up her job and head back into the home? Must they go back if they are to escape the two-income trap? Professor Warren pointed out that at least a few conservative commentators will draw exactly that conclusion from what we have discussed in the past about the creation of the two-income trap and some of the ramifications of having both parents at work. It's interesting, however, that both Professor Warren and, of course, her daughter, as women and also as mothers, have a deep resistance to having the mothers just go back home. They remain dedicated to the best part of the feminist movement, the rock-solid belief that women who want to work should have every opportunity to do so. But what they say is that these are really personal politics, and that isn't really the point. A mass exodus from workplace to home is about as likely as the revival of the horse-drawn buggy. In proper perspective, social and political forces have really changed the shape of women's expectations and their role within the family. New information about the macroeconomic implications of their entry into the workforce, which the two-income trap looked deeply into, is really unlikely to change much in the workforce. The truth is that even if women listened hard to those admonishing them to remain at home, most could not do it in the last generation. Such advice really ignores the fact that families are caught in a trap. Any individual family that chooses to drop down to one income will be immediately penalized, while those who keep both parents in the workforce will gain a strategic financial advantage. Understanding the whole picture, those with both in the workforce may understand that living on two incomes increases their risk of economic collapse, but risks dwell in the future, and the kids have needs that must be met today. Besides, in many families, it is far too late to contemplate pulling mom out of the workforce. For millions of parents who have already committed mom's income to the mortgage, the car payments, and those basic long-term needs, the time for such second thoughts is long past. If mom leaves her job, the family stands to lose everything. Professor Warren's solution is what she calls a better path out of the two-income trap, that is, give families some breathing room. As befits a society in which the safety net must be built one family at a time, money in the bank is still the first line of defense against any economic bump in the road, and we all know this from our personal experience. Any program that helps families save money is a program that helps keep the middle class secure. Currently, the federal government offers a handful of programs that give tax breaks to families who put money aside for specific expenses, such as retirement, medical care, or college tuition. These programs sound promising, but they ask families to do something that is almost impossible in a capricious world. They ask them to predict the unpredictable. To take advantage of these programs, families need to know in advance which expenses will hit them and when they will need extra cash. But what happens when an unforeseen disaster strikes, such as dad loses his job, or mom really feels she needs to get a divorce, or other such tragedies? Families face events that do elude all careful planning. According to Professor Warren, and probably our own personal experience, the first line of defense is our all-purpose passbook savings account, an account that is a tax disadvantage, however. If things get really bad, many families find that the only way to survive is cash out of their retirement accounts, but there is a huge penalty associated with that withdrawal, which is set in place as a disincentive to withdraw early. So, not only does the family wipe out any chance for comfortable retirement, the government just took a huge hunk of their only savings at a time when the family was already under extreme financial stress. The solution is turn the government policy sideways. Instead of asking each family to carve its nest egg into separate little tax advantage slices, middle-class families could be rewarded for all savings, not just savings specifically designated for retirement or education, should be exempt from taxes. Certainly, there are people who oppose such a change for fear that it would disproportionately benefit the wealthy, who are the only ones with ample savings already. This concern could be easily remedied. The tax change could be implemented on a sliding scale so that those with modest means could save tax-free while the wealthy continued to be taxed, or the government could compensate for the lost tax revenues by increasing other taxes on well-to-do households. The bottom line for Professor Warren is that the fear of letting the rich off too easy should not overshadow the fact that middle-class families desperately need to build their own safety nets. America's personal savings rate has plummeted in the past 30 to 40 years, so that now it stands effectively at zero for most people and below zero for many. Encouraging savings shouldn't be about token programs for one or two specified uses. It should be a concerted government policy aimed at helping families build safety nets strong enough to see them through good times and bad. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I have been talking about the two-income trap, wherein both spouses are working. And over the past generation, the two-income trap has left the modern family in a position that is really thick with irony. Today's parents are working harder than ever, far harder than their single-income counterparts of a generation ago, believe it or not, holding down full-time paying jobs and still covering all their obligations at home. Yet, paradoxically, without the safety net once provided by the stay-at-home mother, which we've discussed in detail in the past, they are more vulnerable to financial disaster. They have little money left to build their own safety nets, and government policies tax most of their efforts to provide for themselves. They are caught, can't afford to work, can't afford to quit, and can't survive if something goes wrong. If the risks of the world had remained exactly the same over the past generation, the same risk of getting laid off, the same odds of getting divorced, the same chance that grandmother or grandfather would grow too frail to live without assistance, then the two-income trap would have imposed a moderate dose of hardship on American families as they struggle to survive in hard times. But as we will see now, the risk of the world did not stay the same. Families lost the stay-at-home mother just when they needed her most. So now we'll look at the second myth about financial failure, the first having been the overconsumption myth, and now it's the myth of the immoral debtor. This myth is not about how families spend their money. In fact, it is not about dollars at all. The myth is about good and evil, ethics and righteousness. The myth of the immoral debtor tells a story that begins in the past. In the good old days, goes the story, people paid their bills no matter what. Not because they had more money, but because they had more honor. They paid their bills because it was the right thing to do. They would have died of shame rather than default. But today, the myth declares, the old morality is dead. We live in a time of easy virtue and decaying standards. Professor Warren quotes Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, who said, "A large number of our fellow citizens abuse the system in order to get around debts for which they are very capable of paying." In other words, the debtor is immoral. But according to Professor Warren, the myth doesn't require any proof by this sort of thinking, just an assertion that our neighbors are cheating the system and the rest of us are paying for it. The immoral debtor myth trades on an easy cynicism that passes for sophistication. Only chumps believe that everyone else is playing by the rules. People who are in the know understand that cheating is rampant, that millions of Americans are bankrupt or near bankrupt because, according to Senator Hatch again, they run up huge bills and then expect society to pay for them. When the creditors come calling, the debtors stall, lie, and sooner or later declare bankruptcy so they can walk out on their debts. The response to all of that is there any truth to this claim? Have Americans gone far from an age of honor and decency to a state of moral squalor? It's interesting, though, that one problem with the golden age of bill paying is that no one can agree on when it actually occurred. Around the turn of the millennia, Henry Hyde, who was a Republican congressman at that time, complained that bankruptcy no longer carries with it the social stigma that it did 20 years ago. Bankruptcy is becoming a first stop for some rather than a last resort. Of course, he was pointing to the 1980s. And he was not the first to make this claim. There was a long list of congressmen who complained about declining standards from the better times before the 80s. Yet, in the 1930s, Thomas D. Thatcher, then the Solicitor General of the United States, expressed the often repeated claim that numerous industrial workers were running up bills without intention or ability to pay, and then filing a petition in bankruptcy. So that's the 1930s. Mr. Thatcher, in turn, was preceded by 19th century arbiters of public morality with similar complaints, who themselves were preceded by 18th century critics, led by the venerable preacher Cotton Mather, who in 1716 used his pulpit to decry the early American colonists who could not pay their debts, for which they are to be indicted as not having the fear of God before their eyes. So it seems that the golden age of bill paying was always in the past, and that previous generations always had higher standards and greater integrity. If we listen to the public moralists, we would be left with the impression that America's moral fortitude has been rapidly disintegrating for at least 300 years. So what about today? Have Americans become cunning financial manipulators, ready to walk out on their debts without a moment's hesitation? Has the failure to repay or the decision to file for bankruptcy lost its sting? Professor Warren and Amelia, like always, turn to the numbers. They point out that the conviction that filing for bankruptcy no longer carries the stigma it once did is so widespread that it requires no proof. Whenever a commentator tries to verify the argument, the logic is usually circular. People would not file for bankruptcy if they felt stigmatized by it. Therefore, if bankruptcies are up, stigma must be down. Impossible to disprove. And it sounds pretty good if no one pushes too hard on the logic. A few economists have written about the stigma, but the results are pretty much the same. They focus on a few economic measures, the unemployment rate, the GDP level, the inflation rate, and so forth, without ever actually talking to families, either those who file for bankruptcy or those who do not. These researchers then declare that a decline in stigma accounts for anything and everything that the bare numbers don't explain. For example, if bankruptcy goes up while inflation goes down, it must be that stigma diminished because no other explanation presents itself. But this logic, the rise in bankruptcy filings, might as well have been attributed to the number of SUVs on the road or the number of burritos consumed, with exactly the same result. You see, despite all of this harumphing, there is plenty of evidence that stigma is alive and well among families in financial trouble. I know, I see it every single day. One long-term study of family economics found that fully half of bankrupt families were unwilling to admit, even in an anonymous survey, that they had filed for bankruptcy. Economists have calculated that there are millions of families who, after they took account of the legal fees and other costs, would be better off financially if they sought the protection of the bankruptcy courts. According to one estimate, about 17% of all households in the United States would see a significant improvement in their balance sheets if only they were willing to sign a bankruptcy petition. That's big. I want to repeat that. 17% of all households in America would see a significant improvement in their balance sheets if only they were willing to sign a bankruptcy petition. That's over 18 million households that would profit from a bankruptcy filing, compared with the 1.5 million that actually file each year, suggesting that at least 16.5 or more million families are still trying to pay their debts for some reason that has nothing to do with the legal rules. It would seem that bankruptcy may look like just another financial planning tool to the economists who study it, but it is very different for the families who actually have to file the petitions and show up in court. And we will continue to look at this myth of the immoral debtor more next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I am speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.
Oh,